inspiration for this song by Narottam Das Thakur. Parshura Bhagavad Viraha Janita Viraha. Lamentation due to separation from the Lord and his associates. This is from the Kartana. He who brought the treasure of divine love and who was filled with compassion and mercy, where has such a personality as Srinivas Acharya gone? Where are my Swarup Damodar and Rupa Goswami? Where is Sanata? Where is Raghunath Das, the savior of the fallen? Where are my Raghunath Bhatta and Gopal Bhatta? And where is Krishna Das Kaviraj? Where did Lord Gauranga, great dancer, suddenly go? I will smash my head against the rock and enter into the fire. Where will I find Lord Gauranga, the reservoir of all wonderful qualities?
All right. What he calls concluding words. On November 10, 1974, and he discusses the difference between worshipping the spiritual master in separation and worshipping the spiritual master in his presence, the difference between Vani and Bapu. Once Srila Prabhupada was asked, you miss your spiritual master, and Prabhupada was holding a Srimad Bhagavatam, and he said, a spiritual master and I are never more separated than this. So this is what Prabhupada wrote. I think that his divine grace, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, is always seeing my activities and guiding me within my heart by his words. As it is said in Srimad Bhagavatam, Teni Brahma Vidas Yadi Kaviye, spiritual inspiration comes from within the heart, wherein the Supreme Personality of Godhead, his Paramatma teacher, is always sitting with all his devotees and associates. It is to be admitted that whatever translation work I have done is through the inspiration of my spiritual master, because personally, I am most insignificant and incompetent to do this materially impossible work. I do not think myself a very learned scholar, but I have full faith in the service of my spiritual master, his divine grace, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. If there is any credit to my activities of translating, it is all due to his divine grace. Certainly his divine grace, if he were physically present at this time, would have found this a great occasion for jubilation. So even though he is not physically present, I am confident that he is very pleased by this work, the translation. He's speaking of the compilation for the end of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. He was very fond of seeing many books published to spread the Krishna consciousness movement. Therefore, our society, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, has formed to execute the order of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his divine grace Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. It is my wish that devotees of Lord Chaitanya all over the world enjoy this translation, and I am glad to express my gratitude to the learned men in the Western countries who are so pleased with my work that they are ordering in advance all of my books that will be published in the future. On this occasion, therefore, I request my disciples who are determined to help me in this work to continue their cooperation fully, so that philosophers, scholars, religionists, and people in general all over the world will benefit by reading our transcendental literatures such as Srimad Bhagavatam and Chaitanya Charitamrita. In the Guru Vandana prayer, we chant every day, Janme Janme Prabhu Shai. The spiritual master is with us birth after birth, and the relationship is eternal. So, with Prabhupada's disappearance of the physical body, his continuation of his pure devotional service, we are left with his instructions, or Baba, and worship in separation is greater than worship in the physical presence, because there is a great longing, a fulfilled desire of the spiritual master and to meet the spiritual master. So I'm going to recount some of my remembrances, some of my pastimes with Srila Prabhupada, some of my experiences with him, and pray for the blessings of all of you so that I can speak inoffensively. Om Gena Tinandasya Vandana Salakaya Chaksura Vaitam Gena Tasmai Sri Guravena Sri Chaitana Manodhistam Stavitam Sri Guravena Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Vati Svavaram Vikam. I'll just mention some of the instances in which Prabhupada talked about departing, as he was thinking of departing from this material world. One instance was when he was ill, Prabhupada had had a stroke. And this was in 1977. He had come to recuperate his health in a small house on a beach in California, and devotees were visiting his room. Now, one thing that this brings to mind is the story that Prabhupada narrates in his books about a saint who was giving blessings. To the prince, he said, "My blessing is that you die immediately." To the young brahmachari, to the prince, he said, "You live a very long time, then you will die." To the brahmachari, he said, "You die immediately." To the butcher, he said, "You cannot live nor die." And to the saint, he said, "You can live or die. It doesn't matter." And of course, the rationale is that the prince would have to suffer after his death, so he was granted a long life, so he could enjoy while he could. The brahmachari, while he was youthful and vigorous, and before he would lose his Krishna consciousness, could leave his body immediately. The butcher, who was in a hellish existence in the present life and would be in a hellish existence after life, could neither live nor die. But the saintly person, because he was immersed in transcendental consciousness, living in the spiritual world, even while in the material world, could leave his body at any time. So after this stroke, 1977, Prabhupada was in his room, and he was very grave. He was gazing almost all day long at a picture of Radha and Krishna that Mother Jadarani had painted. It was a little primitive, maybe, by material standards, one of her early paintings. But Prabhupada was chanting, and his picture was to his right, so he was looking at the picture of them all day long, chanting. So the devotees would visit his room occasionally. But we were a little reluctant because Prabhupada was very ill and very grave. So we sat, a few of us went into his room and asked, how are you feeling, Prabhupada? He was looking up at the picture. And he looked down at us, and he looked back at the picture, and he looked down at the devotees, and he said, "What is this body?" And they looked back at the picture and resumed his chanting. We realized that Prabhupada actually was so detached from his body that he was living in the spiritual world just by looking at this picture of Radha and Krishna. And we had to bring him down to this mundane platform of asking him, "How do you feel?" Or how, in other words, "What is your body like?" So he looked at us almost incredulously. What is this body? Why are you asking me such a question? So it was clear that even though he was thinking of maybe having to leave his body, he was at the same time meditating constantly on the spiritual world. This beautiful picture Radha and Krishna showed, the spiritual world. So this was Prabhupada's existence. And it became clear that he was not only knowing he was not his body, but he was continuously living with Radha and Krishna in the spiritual world, and had no concern about whether this material body that he had would continue or not. When he was here in London, it would have been 1969. Did I say 77? It was 1967 when he was at Krishna's beach. When he was here in 1969, he was in an apartment on Baker Street called Farley Court. And Marylebone Road and,
where was it?
Marylebone Road and Baker Street. So he was saying to the devotees that when Tomal Krishna Maharaj and I were in this room, he said, when I leave my body, I want you to take me to Vrindavan. If I leave my body here, I want you to take me to Vrindavan. It was a very morbid thought for all of us to have to hear. Prabhupada was in a little room, his bedroom, and this room had five walls. It had four walls that were shaped like a rectangle, but in one corner was a wall that joined the two 90-degree walls, forming another little wall, and there was a window there. And Prabhupada said that when I sit in this room and chant and look at this window, there was nothing but a brick wall on the other side of it. But he said, this room is shaped exactly like the room in the Radhadhar temple, where I spent many years. And I would look out this window, which was placed just like this window, and I looked out at the Samadhi, call it the tomb of Rupa Goswami. When Prabhupada was in that room, in Vrindavan, he was constantly praying for the mercy of Rupa Goswami. He was not only translating, but he was praying constantly to get strength and the mercy from Rupa Goswami, even though, of course, he wasn't physically present. And Prabhupada got great energy by gazing upon this Samadhi tomb of Rupa Goswami so that he could write his books and fulfill the very difficult order of his spiritual master. So I thought it would be appropriate to recount some of the early days when I was with Prabhupada and then when he came here to England. I wasn't present in Vrindavan when he left us, so maybe some of you who were there can speak on that. When I first met Prabhupada, I was living in New York City, trying to ascertain what was the goal of life, or who I was, or where I was going, or what I was doing. And I had read books. I'd read Bhagavad Gita, I'd read Buddhist books, I'd read books on Confucianism, and so many other philosophies. And when I heard from a friend that there was a Swami living in the Bowery, I became very interested. I'd gone to see one Swami who was a kind of rich people's Swami. And I was very disappointed. People were sitting around in leather chairs. They were a lot older than I was, smoking pipes, and listening to someone who spoke unintelligibly something. I couldn't understand what he was saying. So I was very disappointed. And I had read this Juan Mosquero translation of Bhagavad Gita, and I asked someone from India, what does this mean? Did they have a war after all this talk? It's about peace. And the answer was yes. So what does that mean? Why did they war? And the answer was, well, it's just symbolic. It meant that you have to fight for your life in this material world. So I was very confused about what Bhagavad Gita meant. When I went to the address that this friend had given me, it was in the summer of 1966. There were three drunks sitting out in the front. And the street, the Bowery, full of drunks, smelled like a mixture of beer and urine. That's what it smells like in the summertime in New York. It's also very hot and humid there. So this was in June. There were two drunken men on the steps. They didn't want to let me through. So I sort of elbowed my way through finally and got inside, and it was completely dark. There was no light at all. So I waited to see if there would be any light so that my eyes would get accustomed to it. Just a little tiny bit of light and through the cracks in the door coming from the streetlights outside. It was dark out. And I saw the stairway, so I began to think, well, maybe it's upstairs. And then, because I was still listening, I heard the ching, 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 way off, up above in the distance. So I just followed the stairs with my hand on one wall so that I wouldn't trip. And I went up four flights straight ahead, one after the other, to the back of the building. And the sound was getting louder and louder as I approached the top floor. The top floor, there was a door and some little light through the chinks of the door. And I pushed it open, and I could hear the cartels very loudly. And at the other end sat Prabhupada, about 20 yards, 30 yards, the other end of the room. And a small group of people sat in front of him. I didn't know what to expect. I was just awestruck about the whole thing. The place was no ceiling, just beams and spider webs across the beams. Almost no furniture. And I was just drawn towards Prabhupada. There was a light, a bare bulb, light bulb hanging above him. He sat on a platform about 18 inches off the ground, about 2 by 3 yards. And about 5 people sat in front of him on the floor. So I just began walking towards him. He had one of these, what do you call them, turtlenecks, sweater, and glasses with very thick red rims. And he was chanting. And they would chant in response. So I just magnetically found myself pulling towards them. And when I got to the group, I sat down and I tried to chant along with them. Of course, Prabhupada was this central figure, and I was very stunned. I didn't know what to do. I just tried to chant. He looked very distinguished, very scholarly, and very sat very erect, very poised as he chanted. So I tried to chant along. I didn't know what the words were. I sort of made out Krishna and Hare, but I thought Rama was Lama. So I chanted Hare Lama. And then Prabhupada spoke. He had a big Bhagavatam open. And as he spoke, he spoke a lot of Sanskrit. And I was thinking, this is very difficult to understand, and I had a very hard time hearing what he was saying because of his accent. Gradually I got accustomed, and then I heard him repeating, "I am not this body," in a very almost strident, pleading tone. "I am not this body." And his brow was knit, and he had this look on his face as if to say, "It's so obvious, you fools, why don't you see this? Why don't you understand it?" So it really penetrated, and I kept mulling that over in my mind. What does that mean? I'm not his body. Then I started thinking, well, maybe he's not his body. I'm certainly my body, but maybe he's not. I kept trying to ascertain what that actually meant. So throughout the lecture, I just kept thinking, what does this mean? So then Prabhupada finished, and I was very confused about the meaning of life, and I had a lot of questions. So I thought I'd ask him something that once occurred to me. And I said, if you saw an old man being beaten by a young man, who were walking along the road, what would you do? Would you interfere, or would you just keep going? What would be the right course of action? Because some of the things I read about said you shouldn't get involved in the material world, just be detached. So Prabhupada gave a very elaborate answer, and the conclusion was that you can't know what to do unless you are acting on a spiritual platform. So that confused me even more. What is this spiritual platform? I couldn't figure it out. So then we chanted some more, and I didn't really accept the answer, because I couldn't understand it. But at the same time, I didn't think he was wrong. I just thought that it was beyond my comprehension. So then we chanted again, and then I thought, well, I'll go and talk to him and we'll resolve these philosophical questions. So I approached him. He was sitting, and I was standing. So I was looking down, and he was looking up. And he had a very childlike countenance. It was very childlike, and at the same time, it was very paternal. He reminded me very much of my grandfather. My grandfather was very affectionate and accepting, no matter how much of a rascal I was. So he reminded me of him, and he also had this very innocent expression and smiling. So I was so disarmed that I actually forgot what I was going to say. I was going to sort of continue this question about what one does if there's a fight and you should interfere or not. So then I didn't really know what to say. I just sort of lost it, as they say. And At that time, I was studying Indian music. I was a musician. And the words that just came out of my mouth were, I have a tambura. That's what I said. I have a tambura. And I think I was smiling. And he just immediately, without changing his expression, he said, then bring it. And I was, again, I was completely taken aback. I didn't know what to say. So I just nodded my head, all right. I said, all right. And it suddenly occurred to me that I would be accompanying him on my next visit, that I'd have the honor to play the tambura for this great person. So I thought, well, there's nothing really much else I have to say. I'm going to come back, and I'm going to play the tambura with this great Swami. So I said, okay. And then he said, you'll come? And then he told me the day, 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So I didn't know what to do, so I just decided I would come back. When I came back, I was at the back of the room and I had the tambura. Kirtan was already going on. And this time I offered a pranam. I knew that this was proper etiquette. And I couldn't, and Prabhupada didn't acknowledge me. Maybe his eyes were closed, or maybe he was just immersed in chanting. So I didn't think so much of that. And I started to come sort of hesitatingly towards him. Then he saw me and he started to go like this. And I didn't know what that meant. So I stopped. And then he went again like this. Well, he stopped his car tossing me up like this. So I edged forward a little further. And then I wasn't sure if I was doing the right thing. And I looked at him again and he went like this. I thought maybe it was just some kind of a wave. Went forward stutteringly until I was standing almost right in front of him, and then he went like this, and then I finally figured out that that must have meant to sit down. So I sat right in front of Prabhupada and started to play, and as I was playing, my mind was just thinking about what raga this is, and I was trying to tune the instrument to play in the same melody, and no matter what I would do, his face didn't change, he just kept chanting. I was trying to tune it this way and that way, thinking of this scale or that scale, and Prabhupada was just totally oblivious. But I didn't mind, I just thought he's singing such obscure, esoteric ragas that I'll never figure them out. I just don't know what they are. So Prabhupada was very kind. At that time, he used to address all of the boys there as Mr. And then the first name. There was Mr. Carl, Mr. Mickey, I was Mr. Michael, Mr. Bob. Very respectful. And we felt very elevated. We felt very important that this great man was calling us all Mr. I thought after a few visits to go and pay a personal visit to Prabhupada, I could just talk with him, because the mood was very accommodating. So I went in the afternoon. Traffic was very full of cars and trucks, very busy, going two lanes in both directions, and very, very noisy. So I went to the door and it was locked. I pushed the bell. And there was no answer. I thought maybe there's nobody here. So then I resorted to the tactic New Yorkers sometimes indulge themselves in when they can't raise somebody who's in an apartment on the upper floor. I started to throw pennies at the window, thinking that Paul, who was known as David in Vilamrita, would come to the window. He was staying with Prabhupada. Anyway, I missed the window the first few times. They were a very good baseball player. And finally started hitting the window. And then instead of Paul, it was Prabhupada himself. He threw the window open, he looked out at me, and then he went like this. As if to say, just 1 minute. And then I felt very, very embarrassed that he came to the window himself. And then he came to the door. And I was even more embarrassed that he'd come down all the stairs. And I apologized to Rita. I said, I'm so sorry you had to come down all the stairs. And I had to walk all the way back up. He said, no, no. He said, come on, come on. And then he started taking the stairs two at a time. It's very amazing. And feeling very embarrassed all the time. So when I went up to the room, I went behind this divider that stood behind the place where he was lecturing. It was the first time I had a glimpse of what was going on back there. Prabhupada was sitting in this section between this divider and the window, about 5 feet, very small. His clothes were hanging up on lines drying in the hot summer humid heat of New York. Many pieces of manuscript were stacked around the area. He had an old typewriter, very old-looking typewriter. And I was amazed at how simple he was living, simply he lived. So we talked on different things. And he asked me what I was doing. So I told him that I was a musician and I played the keyboards and so on. And what was I going to do? And I said, well, I was planning to go to India. I was going to study Indian music. And he said, oh, what kind of music? And I said, well, I thought I would study the flute. And he said, oh, didn't you know Indian flute players, they vomit blood? And I was shocked. What does this mean? Indian flute players vomit blood. And I was trying to figure out what that meant. He said, no, he said, I can teach you how to play your piano for Krishna. And I was even more shocked. I couldn't understand how you could play a piano for Krishna, because Indian music didn't have a piano. It was just flutes, harmoniums, and tambours. Anyway, I realized that he was trying to draw me into his mission somehow. And I became a little frightened that if I started acting under his instructions, I would have to become like Paul. Paul was an 18-year-old boy who was living in that loft like a menial servant. And I didn't want to give up my attachment, so I became a little fearful. Anyway, Prabhupada was very merciful and began to talk on other topics. I wanted to know about the politicians, about Gandhi and Nehru. I began to dismantle all my previous conceptions, step by step, how they had ruined India, and everything was in chaos now, and so on and so forth. Of course, I found that very interesting, because I was interested in so many material political topics. And Prabhupada was very giving to feed my materialistic inquiries. So somehow by Krishna's grace, some relationship developed there. And by his mercy, my offenses were somehow being forgiven. So I'll go forward in time now to when Prabhupada came to this country. Shyamsundar and I had been living in San Francisco. And Shyamsundar had written to Prabhupada. He had to come out there and start the temple. And in 1967, actually in late 66, the Prabhupada came in 67. So we had written him in 1968. First, Shyamsundar that wanted to go to England, and Prabhupada was encouraging him very much. So then I had a discussion with Shyamsundar, and we decided to go with Gurudas, who were all householders then, to go with our families, our wives, and come to England. And Prabhupada was encouraging us very much. He had always wanted a temple in England, and he told us that his spiritual master wanted a youth hostel in England, and he sent people to England, they weren't successful, and that he would like this very much. So we spent a year here. We came in September of 1968, and Prabhupada didn't come until the next year, 1969 September. But through writing letters, many, many letters to us, he kept us very enlivened. This was another instance of worship and separation. Just by these letters, we were able to carry on. And sometimes, even though there were thoughts of going to Germany or going somewhere else or going back to the States. As soon as the letters from Prabhupada came, we would all gather around, whoever the letter was written to, and the letters would be read out loud so that everyone would get enlightened. And in this way, Prabhupada kept us going. So, towards the end of 1968, the beginning of 1969, we were in central London and living in an abandoned fruit warehouse in Covent Garden and writing many, many letters to Prabhupada. We decided towards the end of that year to invite all the important people we knew, and we sent out a fancy invitation and invited them to come to this abandoned fruit warehouse. It had a burlap floor, no furnishings, no fittings, nothing. And Jamuna cooked very nicely. We somehow were able to get some rims, utensils, silverware, very fancy stuff, a table and a tablecloth and some folding chairs. So they really didn't know what to expect. And I thought they expected something very much different from what they saw. But we had written to Prabhupada that please send us a tape that we could play for our guests. There was even a member of Parliament there named Tom Driver. He was a prominent MP at the time, passed away. Also an author. There were a few people of very high status, some businessmen we met. About half of them were of this caliber. Of course, only maybe half of them were invited to come, but about 40 people came. So Prabhupada had very obligingly sent us a tape. We had decided to make a little presentation about what our mission was, what we were trying to achieve, and to try to get some help. So Prabhupada sent a tape. It started with him chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. And then he explained that his young boys and girls were there. They wanted to start a temple. He said, he spoke in a very grave voice. He addressed them, "My dear ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming here. He said, I can travel anywhere. I can live in a government palace, or I can sit under a tree. So similarly, our mission is like that. We're not attached to opulence. We don't need to have a very soft place to sit on. We don't have to have utensils to eat with. We don't have to have beds to sleep on. But he said, for the sake of the people of your country, my young disciples need some kind of a premises to establish a temple so that people will be able to come and get the benefit of this great philosophy." So, although we were very nervous before this group of people, as soon as this tape played and we heard Prabhupada's voice, we immediately felt very peaceful. And we looked around at the eyes of everybody and saw that they too felt that they weren't just in the presence of some young neophytes that didn't know very much or know how to be very good hosts. We immediately felt a sense of, that they felt a sense of, belonging. There was something worthy of their being there. So that gave us a lot of strength. And even though it was an awkward situation, because the prasad was nice, at least we were friendly, and Prabhupada's talk was very impressive, very distinguished, they took prasad with great relish, and they congratulated us, they thanked us, and most of them left in a very good mood. And this Mr. Driver became a good friend, enabled us to get the first temple by writing a personal letter to the minister of what was then called the Ministry of Public Building and Works, the Ministry of the Environment now. So there was a benefit there. Getting towards the end of that year, Prabhupada came in September in 1969. When he arrived, it had come to pass that the devotees had made a record of the Hare Krishna mantra produced by Apple and George Harrison. And it was very popular. So at the time of his arrival, we were staying at the house of John Lennon, who sent his Rolls Royce out to collect Prabhupada. So we hadn't seen Prabhupada for about a year. And about maybe 8 or 9 initiated devotees went out to the airport. The record company arranged the VIP room, and they also arranged for Prabhupada to come to them. The Prabhupada wouldn't have to undergo the usual customs and immigration formalities. He was flying in from Germany, so they arranged that some people from immigration went out to the ramp Prabhupada walked down this Lufthansa jet and asked for his passport. They stamped it out on the tarmac, and Prabhupada, Hayagriva, and Purushottam proceeded to this VIP room to meet the devotees. It was a room that had a glass wall with sliding doors on one side, and we could see Prabhupada coming from a distance. And as the devotees saw him, everybody became very choked up. Some were weeping, and some had never seen Prabhupada before. They offered their obeisances from a distance. Prabhupada was accompanied by a policeman, and as he walked towards the room out on the tarmac, it had been raining. Some of the devotees ran out to greet him, Shyamasundara and two other devotees, and they immediately offered their prostrated dandavas on the pavement. Little puddles of water mixed with jet fuel were all over the place, and as they got up, they were covered with pebbles and fuel and water. And the policeman was just incredulous. He was just Prabhupada was grinning from ear to ear. Purushottam and Hayagriva were laughing. So it was quite a spectacle. So anyway, they stood up, and Prabhupada was very graciously nodded in his very amiable way. He had a cane with him. So they escorted him into the VIP room, where flower vases had been set up, and a little table, which was a table made into a chair for Prabhupada, with a cushion was arranged. And because it was arranged by the record company, Apple Records, it was a big reception of newspaper people from Fleet Street. All the heavy-duty city desk sharks of Fleet Street were there. Many of them had their cameras. So they were kind of in the back taking pictures, didn't get too close, and the devotees offered their obeisances. And Prabhupada immediately sat down and started kirtan. Devotees were, many had never seen him, and everybody was very emotional. And as the kirtan built up, the devotees were swaying back and forth. Prabhupada closed his eyes and looked very happy. Later on that day, I guess it was the next day, somebody brought Prabhupada, yeah, it was the next day, a photograph from one of the newspapers. Big photograph across two pages of him chanting. He had his head tilted. He was playing kartals, and Prabhupada said, immediately send this. He told Purushottam Pujara Rani so she can make a painting. So she did that, and later on it was a very, very nice painting. I don't know whatever happened to it, but it was a beautiful painting of Prabhupada. And when he saw the picture, he said, I was in ecstasy. That's what he said. So when the kirtan ended, Prabhupada spoke for a few minutes. He asked after some of the devotees where they were. And then the reporters edged in, and the first time they were taking pictures, the first question one fired at him was, why have you come here? And Prabhupada immediately fired back, I've come to teach you what you've all forgotten, that is God. So they were taken aback. They lost a few beats. And then so Prabhupada... conversation by saying, some of you think that God is dead, some of you think there is no God, but this is a godless civilization. And then he began to explain that my mission is to come here and challenge the atheistic people that there is God, and that God is still alive and active. So in this way he began to preach to them. And then they started asking him other questions, very much muted after the first opening challenge. Why did you come here? Well, they asked him about different evangelists. They asked him how many disciples he had. They asked him how big the movement was. What we could experience that, even though we would have been very intimidated by such challenging questions and photographs and flashbulbs flashing, Prabhupada was completely in control and had them very much at bay and was able to preach very nicely. It was very instructive for us. So then Prabhupada proceeded to John Lennon's house, and There was a meeting later that day with John Lennon and his wife Yoko Ono and George Harrison. Prabhupada spoke very nicely to that. And when he went to his room, he asked Shyamasundar, he said, "This record that you have, what is its sale?" And Shyamasundar said, "Well, Prabhupada, we sold 70,000 copies were sold today." And Prabhupada put that on, and he opened his eyes very wide and said, "Oh, that is very big business." It was unusual to ever see, for us to ever see such a reaction from Prabhupada, see his eyes open wide and see such an approving kind of statement and gesture. Then he looked at us and he said, we all three were there, Gurdas, Shyamasundar and I. He said, "So," he said, "now one of you must immediately go to Oxford and start a center." So we were completely crestfallen, at least I was, because we worked so hard and Prabhupada finally came after 1 year and now someone would immediately have to be sent away and start another center. So it was clear that Prabhupada wasn't going to let anyone rest on their laurels. He wanted the center immediately in Oxford. Then he wanted to know what was going on with the temple, so we had some discussions with him, and he gave us a deadline. That was about the 17th of September, 1959. He said, "You must open it by 14 December." And we thought this was completely impossible to do, because it was just a huge job, and we didn't have enough employees. But somehow Prabhupada gave us the deadline, and we knew that we had to meet it. He said he would stay that long if we could meet the deadline, and if we could keep him busy preaching. So he said, "I haven't yet decided, but you tell me what kind of preaching engagements you can do, and then I'll let you know if I can stay." So Gurdas came back to him, and he made a list of 11 different lectures that Prabhupada could give in a hall in London, Conway Hall. So when Prabhupada saw that list, he said, "Many people will come," and say yes, so that I will stay. So we were very jubilant. And Prabhupada came into this Conway Hall in Red Lion Square at the temple in Berry Place and lectured every week. Also, sometimes there he was challenged. After the first lecture, one man in the back said, "Why did you come? Why didn't you just stay in India and preach to the leaders of your country? Wouldn't that have a greater influence than coming to England?" And Prabhupada said, "You are a great politician, therefore I'm approaching you. Is that all right?" He was silent. And Jamuna was in the middle of the stage and she let out a big hearty laugh. We were very immature in those days. It sort of resounded from wall to wall. Nobody else thought it was so funny. Of course we did, but we kept it inside. That was another instance of how Prabhupada was always very poised and very much in control in any situation. At one point, he moved. He had to actually move to John Lennon's place, and he wanted to move into the temple where construction was going on. So a bit of a controversy erupted, because some of the group didn't want Prabhupada to go to the temple, but rather preferred that he would go to a flat somewhere where it wasn't so noisy. Anyway, Prabhupada finally conceded and allowed him to be situated in this flat. That's the place where they had this funny-shaped room. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj had to come over. So one day, Prabhupada said that his watch had stopped. And he said, "My watch has stopped. I want you to get it fixed immediately." So we were sitting there. He said, "Can you do it immediately?" And I said, "Yes, Prabhupada." And he said, "Very well." So he said, "I'm lost without my watch. So do it immediately." So then he took off his watch and handed it to me. I thought, well, if he's lost without his watch, we have to do something. So I said, "Prabhupada, will you take my watch so you can have something to wear?" And as I was saying that, I was taking it off and handing it to him. He sort of paused as I had my hand out, and he looked at me and said, "All right, let's be practical." He took it and he put it on. And I wasn't really thinking about what I was doing at the time. And then I sort of started to realize, because Tamal Krishnan was looking at me in a very strange way. And when we left the room, he said, I can't believe it. You gave Prabhupada your watch. And he was smiling. I suddenly realized that I was doing something very strange in Vaishnavism. So the construction was going on, and the day for the grand opening was nearing. During that time, there were many different engagements. Prabhupada would visit people's homes. He would see the TV shows that would be about devotees, because the record was out. They were very popular figures at that time. There was a program called Late Night Lineup on the BBC. It was very popular. So they invited us to come. They sent a van. This was back when we were still at John Lennon's house. About 10 o'clock at night. It was a late program, about 11 or 12, I think. So, Prabhupada, 6 or 7, was put into the BBC truck, and we went down to BBC. And it was a live program. So, in the foyer, people sat drinking cocktails. And this was the place where the guests were supposed to meet the moderator and strike up a rapport with them, so it would be natural when I got on camera. Anyway, the man came out, he was very nice, and offered us some drinks, non-alcoholic drinks. And then some other people came into the room, they looked at the devotees, and they looked at us and they said, why is this mark worn off? But it's not on his. Prabhupada had put on a fresh tilak. We were too spaced out to consider that we were going on TV and our tilaks all got to be rubbed off at the end of the day. So as well, it just wears off. And they looked at each other and they said, well, we can take you into the makeup room. And we all looked at Prabhupada, who was just completely impassive. So we thought, all right. So they took us into the makeup room, sat us down, and with a very fine brush and white acrylic paint, and that was very nice. We didn't realize that it would take a week to get off. But anyway, we were ready to go on with Prabhupada. So they had us sit on cushions, on a carpet rather than on chairs. And the moderator sat on the floor opposite each devotee, and he went around to each devotee with a hand microphone and interviewed everyone. And so everybody spoke. It was on Prabhupada because he was really starting to lose it. And we were wondering, what's he going to do? What's he going to say? This is a live broadcast. Just at the last second, Prabhupada came to the rescue and interjected. But of course, it is a great credit to the British people that they built such a great civilization in such a climate. And he immediately said, oh yes, that's true, it is. Immediately took up the conversation, having been rescued by Prabhupada's mercy. So it was an instruction for us to see how expert Prabhupada was at helping someone save face and just being very kind. Another time when we saw Prabhupada's great genius at work in persuasion was when we came to acquire the Radhavandishwara Desis in East London. There was some, of course most of you have read about this in the Lamrita, but maybe a little personal account. As there was some dispute as to whether or not these deities would actually be donated by the family, Prabhupada began to speak to them at length in Hindi. So a devotee named Radha Raman, Tamal Krishna Maharaj, and Jamuna and myself were there. And we could only understand a little bit of what he was saying. He would once in a while bring in a few English words. So this went on for a very long time, very serious, deep discussion about whether they could donate the deities. And then Prabhupada said something, and all of a sudden they started to laugh. Like it was as if he told them a joke. And then from that point on, the whole tenor of the conversation was very jovial. And they would say something, Prabhupada would laugh, he'd say something, they would laugh. And suddenly the whole mood changed, as if they were just exchanging jokes in Hindi. And then Prabhupada said, come on, Krishna Maharaj, you can take Krishna, you can take him out to the van. Go ahead, take him out to the van. No, pick him up now. Just go over there, walk over there, pick him up, take him out to the van. Now, go ahead, now, take him to the van. And he started talking to them in Hindi. And they were joking back and forth. And then even Radharani would pick up Radharani in the same way. Well, he kept speaking with them. So then we got up, conversation went along, we all shook hands, thanked everybody. And as we were driving away, we were all sitting in the back, touching the deities, sitting in the back of this van. And Prabhupada was very silent, he didn't say anything. And we drove quite a ways, and we thought that maybe Prabhupada would say something. But this conversation, he didn't say a word. So finally, I said, Prabhupada, it seems like you've kidnapped Krishna. And he laughed, and he said, yes, he said, when I was a young man, he said, I was always expert in debate. And then he said, one time I wanted to borrow some money from my banker, and he didn't want to loan me the money. I had a very nice scheme. But he had also an even nicer scheme to keep me from getting the money. So I had a long talk with him, and finally I defeated him. And then he laughed, and he said that, so he finally said to me, Mr. Day, he said, you should have been a politician. And he just laughed and laughed. And to go back to the temple with the deities. So when it came time on the 14th of December to install these deities, Prabhupada was in the deity room, and Shyamsundar and Tirthapada and other devotees had stayed up all night to finish the temple. They hadn't slept at all. So they weren't there. They had collapsed at some point. They might have even been up the night before, I don't know. They worked very, very hard. And as a token of his reciprocation, even though Prabhupada had at one time protested that such an elaborate ceiling was being built in that temple made from imported California redwood, you've probably seen pictures of it. Sometimes it was likened to an upside-down ark inside of a Noah's Ark, this kind of gothic shape to it. Very beautiful, actually. Prabhupada asked that a plaque be installed in front of the temple. This temple was built by the hard labor of effort of Shyamsundar Das Adhikar. So anyway, he and Tirthapada and the others were collapsed somewhere. And Prabhupada and... were you there, Dhanajai, in that back room? When we were installing the deity?
No. I was doing second initiation. Obviously, I was just standing there.
So... we were on the back of the curtain, and the room was filled. There was no ventilation. It was very stuffy, right? It was approaching maybe 40 degrees or beyond, and very, very humid. Now, what had happened was that the pillars that Shyamsundar had made to hold a rectangular-shaped canopy had no place to be fastened onto the marble foundation. And there was no place to fasten this canopy. So they would just be freestanding, and the canopy would just balance on it. So Prabhupada, Radharaman, and Tamakrishna Rush and Jamuna were in the back there. And we couldn't get this canopy to rest on these wooden pillars that were painted with silver paint. It just wouldn't happen. Every time we would put the canopy up, it would slip, and we'd have to try again and try again. At one point, the canopy slipped, and it looked as if they were going to fall on the deities. And Prabhupada immediately jumped up on this marble platform and put one hand up. Later on, devotees remembered that reminded them of Krishna holding up Govardhana Hill. And he was perspiring. All of us were perspiring so much. There was perspiration all up and down our faces. Our clothes were completely drenched. And Prabhupada was in great anxiety trying to get this altar settled. And so finally, when it was clear that we couldn't get this canopy to stand on end, on the pillars, he said, just take it out of the room. And I was just perspiring like anything. I thought, well, how am I going to take it out of the room? It's filled with people. There's no room to even walk. What's the speak of taking this out? I'll have to walk in front of everybody. There's no room to walk out. It'll be so embarrassing. They'll know that the altar wasn't completed. The canopy didn't fit, and I have to walk out and it's right through them and go out to the front door, because the front door was at the other end of the room. so I did all right. And I could barely carry this thing out. I went out to one side of the curtain. I looked at this huge mob of people. And they were all looking up at me, and I was looking at them. I didn't know about the procedure in Vaishnava etiquette that if you put your hand out like this, that people will make it an aisleway for you to walk through. So I really didn't know what to do. And I just started stumbling over people trying to make my way to the front door. And finally, when they realized what I was doing, they made a little very narrow aisleway. I could sort of tightrope walk my way through and finally got to the front door. And then I got to the front door and I thought, what am I going to do? I can't just put it out here on the street, this altar, this part of the altar. I can't do this. But then I asked them to boys, you just have to do it. You just have to take it outside. Because the hallway was full of people, so there was no place to put it. So I ended up putting it out in front of the building, in a little fenced off area between the footpath and the building. And I came back, and Prabhupada was making the final preparations. He said, we'll just have to go ahead and open the deities without this. Anyway, Prabhupada had bathed the deities, and then finally the curtains were open, there was an arti, and then Prabhupada spoke. And many of these guests were some of the people that we've been cultivating. Some of them were very wealthy people, very important people. And the thrust of Prabhupada's lecture was that, thank you ladies and gentlemen for coming here. I want to inform you that this facility we have for my disciples is too small. We must immediately get a larger place. So please, please help these young boys and girls. Again, he wasn't going to let anybody be complacent even for a moment. And it was true. We were so squished in there. We were sleeping shoulder to shoulder on every floor, even though it was five floors. It was very small. And even before Prabhupada had installed the deities, he had us looking for different premises, and he was personally going to look for them. So Prabhupada was thinking many years into the future. So he stayed, he greeted the guests, he satisfied everybody, and he left us with the notion that our real work was not over, but that it lay ahead, that it would lay ahead to get a bigger place so that we could accommodate the many people who want to become devotees of Krishna. So, thank you very much. Sorry, I went over a little time. I just want to conclude by saying that since Prabhupada departed, his mission has been very much alive here. The spirit that he left us with, that one should fight to the bitter end. There's a famous incident when he was in New York, very ill, on his way back to India. He said, I want to be like Arjuna, I want to die with my boots on. That spirit has obviously prevailed. We've been in a great struggle here to keep this temple open and accommodating all the many guests who want to come. And I think that we can feel very much in Prabhupada's presence here. And we feel, at least I do, I'm sure all of you feel very confident that we're not going to go anywhere ever. And that this premises is going to accommodate more and more. And more people and become an even more important center for spreading Krishna consciousness all over the country. Thank you very much. I don't remember that. Was that in the Prabhupada Lila Meeta? What was the mood like when Prabhupada left the planet? Well, I was in Los Angeles, and Prabhupada had been sick, and I had thought that... I actually never allowed myself to really think what it would be like, and what should happen, and how things should be done, and so on. It's sort of... I think I had the idea that things would probably completely fall apart. I didn't want to sort of think of what could be done, or how what the future. I just didn't allow myself to think beyond that point. So, but even when Prabhupada was very ill, where I was, there was a... We knew Prabhupada was very ill, and then in the morning, there was someone announced that... after Mangalarti sometime, all the devotees had assembled, there was an announcement went around to it. A community with a lot of different buildings, so someone was dispatched to go around to the buildings and informed that Prabhupada, there would be an announcement, a very important announcement. So a lot of us had this sense that it would be, this would be Prabhupada leaving, or that he had deteriorated much more because he was very, very ill. So we all assembled in the temple, and it was about 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning. And Ramachandra was the GVC then. So he sat down in front of Prabhupada's Vyasa-san, and he said, Prabhupada is gone. And the room was very silent, and we heard a few people choking and weeping in the room. And he was also, he couldn't speak, he was very choked up. And then gradually he started to say that we would have... we would chant prayers for Prabhupada, we would chant the samsara prayers. And everybody was just stunned, yes, so I can say. Everybody was just stunned. Most of the boys were very quiet. And I, for myself, there were just tears streaming down my face. I couldn't speak, I was very stunned. I didn't know what to think or do or say. And it was just very quiet. And then I think we were going to assemble in the temple after about an hour, because nobody really knew for sure what to do. There was going to be some prayers and some discussion. I remember when I walked out of the temple that someone who I didn't know very well said that I don't think he knew that Prabhupada had left. He was a devotee, didn't live in the temple. And he said that he wanted to fix my car. When he heard that it was broken, and he wanted to come and fix it. So all of a sudden, I found myself talking to him about fixing the car. It was a very unreal conversation, like, what did this have to do with anything? My car being fixed. It didn't have any meaning. It was just sort of talking. The words were coming out of my mouth, but there was no meaning to those words. But at the same time, I was thinking that somehow life is going on in some way, in ordinary life. Without Prabhupada. And somehow I was beginning to think that life would go on without Prabhupada's physical presence, because I could talk to this person about my car. And he, because he didn't really know what had happened, I don't think he even knew that Prabhupada was really sick. He was just talking to me in a perfectly normal frame of mind. Anyway, gradually, it began to dawn. And there was a lot of grief. When I got back to my ashram, Shamsundar phoned, and he heard about Prabhupada. It was very difficult for me to speak, I remember. He was talking kind of in ordinary tones, but I was just kind of choking and crying. I couldn't really speak very properly. Anyway, when the devotees assembled, they began to realize that somehow life was going to go on. And as the hours went by, we found ourselves doing many kind of seemingly mundane things. So there was a press conference, and we talked about Prabhupada, because they were very much about coming to the temple. They wanted to know. But I would say it was a mood of being stunned and gradually lamentation, great lamentation, and gradually realizing that somehow things would have to continue and we would have to figure out how those things would continue. And we would have to take great responsibility in order to see that things would continue, even though we wouldn't have the Prabhupada there. There was a gradual realization that we, at least I can speak for myself, I think it's true of a lot of people, where I was, that we couldn't depend on going to Prabhupada and asking him questions anymore. We couldn't get answers to our dilemmas, our personal problems. We wouldn't be able to speak to him about how the world should expand. We'd somehow have to rely on his whatever we already had. So that gradually dawned on us, gradually. There was a very grief-stricken sensation. It went on for quite a long time. Anything else? I don't know if that moment's come yet. I still try to accept Prabhupada. It just was I really can't say that I have, but for me it was a very slow and gradual process. And it just took many years. I had one experience when the Bombay Temple opened. This was in the end of 1977, after Prabhupada left. And he wanted this temple to open, and I had my first assignment to go to India and try to do something in India with the media to publicize the Bombay Temple open, which was in January of 1978. So somehow by Krishna's grace, it was a very difficult thing to do. I'd only been in India a few times before, and I went to Delhi from Bombay, and I went around and visited all the foreign media people. So on the day of the opening, which was January 1978, many of them flew from Delhi to Bombay, many important people. About 50 actually came. And it was something that I really didn't expect to happen. People from the Newsweek and television networks, and New York Times, many, many people, about 50 came, and they were accommodated in a room. It took 50 devotees to host them. And it was a very big press coverage. Anyway, before the day ended, it was a grand opening. We worked very hard, devotees in the DBT, to be the host and set up interviews for all these people. And there was a big procession on the beach with fireworks and elephants. And thousands of people came to the temple. It had been a very big struggle, if you know the history of this temple, how it came. It was almost lost several times. I just remember feeling after that that Prabhupada was very pleased. And that nothing I'd done before was really very significant. And that somehow, not that I'd done it, but that somehow Prabhupada was pleased. I felt that I'd done something that was at least part of the effort I had taken part in, this was pleasing to Prabhupada. And I felt that Prabhupada could be satisfied, even though I wasn't personally there to see him. I guess my experience is that if I did something that was very difficult, I felt I was surrendering to Prabhupada. That was sort of my measure. If I worked hard and it seemed like I wouldn't be able to continue, but somehow I did it anyway. That was about as far as I could take this sense of surrender, feeling that I was giving myself to Prabhupada. I also feel it's an unending process, and that someday maybe that there will be some real surrender. Did you ever criticize who? For having women living in the temple? Sometimes he wouldn't want. He wouldn't. I remember there were times when he didn't want couples living together in the same room in the temple. There were some occasions where he didn't permit that. I don't have any other recollections, but personal experiences probably less than that. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.